Coming up next, Futures in Biotech with David Baker about his game Foldit, where he crowdsources protein folding.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 92. Foldit, crowdsourcing God's work.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans, that would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Marc Peltier. Today, we're going to talk about a little bit about evolution, a little bit about intelligent design, and sort of the crossroads of sort of the creation of life's particles, proteins. And to do so, I brought in a subject matter expert guest host, Marcus Volter, and he's the editor-in-chief of a podcast called Omega Tau Podcast in Germany. And he has both German and English versions. So if you don't speak German, then you can get his RSS. So I'd like to welcome you to the show. You're our informatics, software engineering subject matter expert. Welcome. It's our first time here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on board. I like your microphone. Great. He's a friend of TWiT, and he's a new friend to TWiT. So this is great. It's first time having him on Futures in Biotech. And today's guest is very much a cross field guest. So I think having two of us asking questions we might be able to approach his intellect. All right. So our guest today has won numerous prizes, awards and prizes. He won the Raymond and Beverly Sackler International Prize in Biophysics, the Foresight Institute Feynman Prize. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences awarded him the 2005 Newcomb Cleveland Prize for his work creating TOP7, his group's first artificial protein. And it was published in Science in 2003. And this is a prestigious award where they take the best published work and recognize it. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, member of the National Academy of Sciences. He's Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator, professor of the Department of Biochemistry at University of Washington, but also adjunct professor of bioengineering, adjunct professor of genome sciences, of physics, of chemical engineering, and of computer science. I'd like to welcome Dr. David Baker to the show. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Your science is very foundational. It's basically, it covers the basic essence of life and how proteins are made. And you've done a lot of stuff with respect to understanding folding and sort of taking advantage of those elements of understanding. Perhaps you could tell us how you got started in the area of protein folding. What is protein folding and how you got into that area?
Well, let's see. Proteins are the miniature machines which carry out essentially all the important functions in our bodies and in living things generally. And in order to carry out their functions, they fold to very precise shapes, because like any machine carrying out a particular function, doing a job requires a very specific three-dimensional architecture. So each protein in our bodies is coded by a different gene. Genes specify amino acid sequences. These amino acid sequences each correspond to a unique protein. So each unique amino acid sequence in our bodies will fold up to a unique protein structure. But how to go from the amino acid sequence to the three-dimensional structure is an unsolved problem. Well, biology can do it, but we have a very hard time predicting it and or understanding it. And it's really the most elementary case of biological self-organization, because you don't have non-biological molecules spontaneously self-assembling into functional states. And I think that's what really fascinated me at the beginning. How does this most elementary aspect of life actually happen? And what we've really moved on to since trying to understand how it works is trying to make new proteins that do new things.
Let me ask you, how does your microphone... sorry to interrupt. We're also have a lag because Marcus is in Germany, so we'll probably have a one-second lag. If David, Dr. Baker, you can move your microphone a little bit up so you're not breathing on it. It'll clean up the audio a little bit.
Okay, how's that?
Good. Very good. Marcus, go ahead.
So I was just going to ask, protein folding sounds to me like the three-dimensional structure of the protein is somehow important for what it does in the body. I always thought it was more chemical and to some extent electrical. How does the structure fit in, the three-dimensional structure?
Well, the three-dimensional structure is really critical. Like I said, it's for any machine to work, it has to have a precise structure. So for example, some proteins are the components of muscle, actin, for example, and it folds into a three-dimensional shape that then allows it to self-assemble with other copies of itself to form long filaments, and those are the basic constituent of muscle. So the three-dimensional shape really is critical to how proteins work. If proteins don't fold properly, then all sorts of diseases result. So Alzheimer's and other diseases are essentially come about when proteins don't fold properly.
Okay.
It's not a simple problem too, right? If you consider how many proteins and protein conformations there are in the human body, if you take our 20,000 genes, each making a protein, and then different splice variants of those, so you add maybe a twofold factor, and then you add post-translational modifications where you have sugars and lipids and all kinds of phosphates binding and changing structures. How many combinations are there in life, right?
There are a very large number of combinations. I mean, but your estimate of a two or threefold factor larger is probably correct. But that's just in the human genome. If you consider all the different, you know, living things on Earth, the number of different proteins is really huge. It's going to be in the many millions. But again, that's just a small subset of the proteins, that the amino acid sequence that hold up to structures that actually do interesting things. And so the design problem, which is what we really focus on now, is how do we make new proteins that carry out new functions like fixing carbon dioxide or making biofuels or blocking the flu, or fighting cancer. How do we make use of the same principles that biology has used in the proteins that are that carry all the processes of life? How do we take those same rules and now make brand new things?
Could you please, sorry to interrupt on this. We're getting some comments in the chat room. If you please move your mic as far up as it can go, maybe up to your nose. We're getting a lot of
questions. Okay, how about that?
It sounded great. Yeah. It's hard to tell. That's good. As long as Liz can still hear
right
you.
By my eyes.
Well, that's actually really good. It's actually good. Clean.
Excellent.
Good. Awesome. To think about it, what you're talking about here, biologically, right, with millions of possible ways those amino acid changes or amino acid chains, like, you know, spaghetti fold up into that three-dimensional spaghetti ball that's functional, how come it always works, right? I'm alive standing here with a million combinations of these proteins folding the correct way. Maybe half of them of mine are correct, but
That's right. I mean, it's really quite fascinating, and I think that's the problem which got me really fascinated by this problem in the first place. Is how does it work? How do all these proteins fold up so effectively and so efficiently? And it's even more remarkable when you consider how many different possible conformations any single protein has. It's astronomical. So somehow proteins navigate the huge space of possibilities and fold up to a single unique structure, which is really critical to them carrying out their biological function.
This is kind
so
of
how
what
does a
blows
protein?
Oh, well, let me just say one thing. This is what kind of blows me away is that we thought we had it in 1973 when Atkinson won the Nobel Prize. That's all you needed is that backbone, right? And it would naturally just fold together, right?
Well, that's true. The information is completely contained in the amino acid sequence. So if you make a particular amino acid sequence in a test tube, and we do this all the time, and let it fold up, it will fold up to the right structure. So biology solves the problem of finding the right state very, very easily. But it's turned out to be a difficult problem on the computer to do this, for us to reproduce that. So, and again, what we're trying to do is make new amino acid sequences that fold up in new ways. And that is a... It's not a totally trivial thing to do.
So when you're building new structures, new proteins, do you know which one you want to build in terms of the exact structure, and how do you know what they then will do? Or are you trying to reconstruct existing proteins to, I don't know, you know, fix some deficiency in some humans?
We're trying to make completely new things that have never existed in any shape, way, or form. Completely, completely new. And what we, when we make them, we try and make them to do specific tasks. So, for example, last year we published an article in Science showing that we could design new proteins, completely new proteins, that bind very tightly to the influenza virus, the Spanish flu 1918 H1N1, and block it from getting into cells. So we are making up proteins from scratch that never existed. We're synthesizing them in the lab and then testing their function experimentally. So when we make up proteins, we're generally making them because we want a particular function that doesn't exist, for example, blocking the flu or fixing carbon dioxide.
So quick question. I'm an engineer, right? So when I think about designing something, then this is ideally a deterministic process where I have some kind of, you know, plan to go, how to go about that. Is this the same in your case, or are you basically experimenting and then checking whether things work out or not?
It's basically the same, except our ability to design is probably not quite as good as yours and most engineers design the kinds of things that they want. So in practice, we have to make a number of designs. Not every design we make works. So basically what we do is we design, in the case of the flu binders, for example, we designed 50 proteins that, according to our computational design model, were predicted to bind tightly to the virus. We tested each of those experimentally, and the revolution in synthetic biology, which allows now the synthesis of genes very, very easily, really makes this possible. So literally what we do is we do the design calculation, deterministic, out comes a sequence. We fill out an order form on the web to buy a synthetic gene that encodes that sequence. That synthetic gene comes back, and we then make the protein and see whether it binds the virus. Now, the new twist on this is that we're now getting folded players to actually design new proteins, and we're testing those. We just had a paper in Nature Biotechnology a couple weeks ago showing that folded players could improve designs we had made of a new enzyme catalyst for a chemical reaction that's not catalyzed by naturally occurring enzymes.
Let's talk about Foldit, but before we do, you mentioned this is where the paradigm shift happened. You created software that allowed people to crowdsource this evolutionary process, using intelligent design based on the frameworks of the properties of protein folding. But this is a paradigm shift, I think, from 37,000 feet, this is where the building blocks of life now are no longer under the control of, environmental pressures and adaptation, where you're limited by the process of life. You're using life sciences here, but you're taking into a completely, the paradigm shift is going into that synthetic, going from natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me give you some examples. For example, some of the things I'm very excited about are making brand new classes of materials. So we're all familiar with biological materials like silk and wool and, all these things. But those all evolved to solve very specific problems that biology faced, like spider silk or, wool to keep, sheep warm or whatever. But there are all sorts of kinds of materials that don't exist yet that we should be able to make by basically employing the same type of the basic principle is if we can design amino acid sequences that fold up in any way we want, we can design them to fold up in ways so they self-assemble to form materials with all kinds of new properties. So I think you're totally right. It's a paradigm change. We're not just working with what biology came up with. We're trying to make completely new things that never existed, but using what we understand about the way that nature's done it.
you know, that paradigm shift is important. As a biologist here, I've got, say, I want to look for a protein, a way to block how two proteins come together, and I'm going to make a third protein. What I would have naturally done is gone into a, you know, various lysates of where you crack open cells, extract millions of different proteins, or use maybe purified libraries of proteins and screen them for things that would block, taking what is given to me. And I really appreciate somebody says, well, you know, we could do that, or we could save the millions of dollars of screening 100,000 or 500,000 independent proteins, and we'll just get some people out there to see if they can design it.
Yeah.
So
let me tell you
a lot of time. Go ahead.
Well, let me tell you how we approach that problem, because that's actually one of the things we're working on hard now. You've got two proteins that interact, and you want to block that interaction, say because that interaction mediate is important in cancer. What we do is we pull those, we sort of on the computer, we turn those proteins around so their surfaces are pointing towards us, so to speak. And then you can view that surface of that protein kind of like a climbing wall with possible handholds and footholds. So then we basically on the computer work out how to place disembodied amino acids against each of those surfaces in such a way that they bind really tightly. So it's kind of like placing the hands and feet of a protein on against that surface, and then we design a protein that holds all those amino acids in place, and then we make the protein and test to see whether it actually blocks that protein-protein interaction. That's what the process is. And I wanted to say one more thing. All of these, everything I'm describing is very, very computationally intensive. And what's made this possible is a project called Rosetta at Home, where we have about 400,000 volunteers worldwide who contribute spare cycles on their computers to solving these problems. So when we're trying to design new flu virus inhibitors, for example, or new possible anti-cancer things, we set up the design calculations locally, but then we send out the computing to the public, essentially, who then does the calculations on their computers, sends the results back to us. Then we look through those results and choose a subset of them to make and test experimentally.
So the evaluation is a manual process, and you basically just use the cycles of the machines. So they do the work, and then you look at the results, and then you make the decision which one are good and which are not good.
Yeah. So the filtering through is largely automatic. So we have criteria. For example, we will take all the solutions that come back from all Rosetta at Home participants, and we will sort them based on their predicted binding energy, their predicted mm-hmm. binding affinity, and then we'll make the highest, the ones predicted to bind the most tightly.
Okay.
I'm trying to get this. With respect to Rosetta, I could see proteins floating in a test tube and working or not working. But in a predictive model, here's the question. I understand how you could model and get chains of amino acids to fit various conformations that are predicted to happen, and you sort of do that and work out. But then, is it as simple as once you have, I mean, there's so many millions of combinations. That's where I'm having a hard time. So many millions of combinations when you take 50 to 100 amino acids, there's so many ways for them to go. How do you, you know, translate? Will it just, can you fold them slowly and like
Right. So we can't possibly enumerate all the possible amino acid sequences and fold them up individually. Instead, the way the calculations work is we can compute the energy of any particular structure with any particular sequence using a force field we've been developing. It's not perfect, but it's a reasonable description of reality at the atomic level. So to design a sequence that will fold up to a particular structure, we start with the backbone of that structure without any side chains on it. And then we do a Monte Carlo search over the possible amino acid sequences for the sequence which has the lowest energy on that structure. And using algorithms we've developed, rather than taking astronomically long, as you might imagine, it actually only takes a few minutes to sort through this very, very large space of possible configurations and identify those that that are the lowest energy, which would be the ones we then make. So we have explicit algorithms which sample over possible amino acid sequences and search for the lowest energy ones.
So you mentioned Monte Carlo. Maybe you want to explain that. Probably not everybody knows this. Have you all also played with genetic algorithms or other kind of directed search algorithms?
Yes. So much of our research is concerned with search. How do you find the best, the lowest energy sequence for a given structure? I should point out that the structure prediction problem, which we also work on, is finding the lowest energy structure for a given sequence. That's for the problem of predicting what the sequences in nature do. We know what the sequences are, so we want to predict the structure. But in this case, in the design case, we don't know the sequence. We make up some new structure, and we want to find a sequence that has very low energy in that structure. So the basic way Monte Carlo search works at its simplest is you take a backbone structure, you try some combination of amino acids, or you start with that to begin with. You substitute in a new one that's randomly chosen. If it makes the energy better, you keep it. If it makes the energy worse, you throw it away. But you flip a coin first, and if it didn't make it too much worse, then you keep it. You accept it. So you can sometimes move uphill. That's why it's called Monte Carlo, the coin flipping part.
Right.
there are genetic algorithms we also use. So there are many methods that have been developed, some inspired by natural evolution, for searching to optimize a particular function.
Okay.
I think I'm starting to get it. So you start with a model of what would be the first perfect protein to go prevent those two proteins from interaction. It could be, for example, HIV virus, a capsid, or it's actually
yes,
a glycoprotein.
Exactly. Protein. Yeah.
And the sugar on top of the wherever it infects, the white blood cell, so to prevent it from popping in. So you design that structure, and then you keep going with different sequences of amino acids that will then fit into that position with the lowest amount of energy.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, in the case of HIV or the flu or a virus, we actually design structures with different shapes because there are different shapes a protein could have that fit into the region where the flu uses to get into cells. So that's why we have many different possible designs. There are many different strategies. You know, if you're designing a bridge, there are many different ways you could build a bridge over a river or something. And in the same way, if we're trying to prevent a virus from getting into cells, there's in general going to be a number of ways to do it. And so with Rosetta at home, we have a lot of computing power, so we can explore many different options. And that's what the students and postdoctoral fellows in my group do, is set up, we explore different ways of achieving, of designing, say, a flu blocker or an enzyme that fixes carbon dioxide or, you know, making a new material.
This is very, very, I can't understate how difficult it is to actually get something with biological activity through design. So I certainly respect your work because you've been successful at it. You know, and the way we tend to do it is we'll design something or we'll take something out of nature and then we'll throw a mouse or a rat to walk across that bridge to see if it dies, right?
Yeah. It's just crazy. Well, so, yeah, you know, that's right. So we'd like to be able to compute everything. I mean, you know, we'd like it so that you came up with there's some brand new version of the flu and in 2 days we could make something which would block it and inhibit it so that, you know, that would, so in case of a pandemic, there wouldn't be a problem. You just quickly make something that would block it. Of course, we're not that good yet. So we're working towards there to have very rapid ways of being able to come up with, antidotes to newly emerging, you know, problems.
Well, you'd be named McCoy, you know, Dr. McCoy, if you could just, you know, synthesize an antidote and get it to work. But do you see that happening?
I think that things. One of the things that's getting better is just synthesizing DNA, because our what comes out of the computer, say from Rosetta at home or from Foldit. I told you Foldit players. The general public is now contributing to design better flu inhibitors. In fact, one of the Foldit puzzles that's up right now is designing inhibitors for a flu virus we don't yet have an inhibitor of. Anyway, so it's actually pretty easy to make lots of different designs. The limiting step is actually the making genes that encode them, but methods for synthesizing DNA keep getting better all the time. So, I'm describing results that have come when we've been testing maybe 10 or 20 designs. If instead, but the computer is spitting out, you know, 20,000. If we could test all 20,000 rapidly, which I think is feasible, then there's every reason to think that the success rate should go up considerably.
So how many do you do? How many? Sorry to...
No, go ahead.
we got this huge lag in Germany and Cleveland and Petaluma and Seattle. So how many designs can you actually translate from in silico to wet bench experiments to verify that they work? And how many does it take to start?
That's the key question, right? So right now we can do on the order of, for any given problem, we make on the order of 50 designs. But the limiting step is synthesizing those 50 synthetic genes. But with synthetic biology coming online, it will be possible in not too long with new technologies to actually synthesize 50,000 genes. So we'll be able to test 100 times more things than we can test now. And that will really change the... I think we'll be able to get much more effective things much more rapidly.
So one thing we kind of assumed is just possible is that once you have designed a protein, you can actually build it. So from my perspective, it is much more interesting or surprising that you can actually build the actual real-world structures that represent the protein.
The key point is DNA, that's really an essential question, and maybe I didn't make that clear. We designed the protein on the computer. It has an amino acid sequence that's predicted to fold up to a three-dimensional structure. The building, the way we build it, is we don't build the protein, we build the DNA that encodes it. That's when I say a synthetic gene, I mean a piece of DNA that specifies the amino acid sequence of the designed protein. And it's very easy now to synthesize DNA. And so when I spoke just a moment ago about being able to test 50 designs, it's because we can build 50 synthetic genes. But when we can build 50,000 synthetic genes, we'll be able to test 50,000 designs all in parallel.
But you just want to have to design one and have it work.
We would like to be able to just design one, but we're not quite there yet. And if we can test many things, we'll be able to improve the methods faster. So in parallel, obviously, we're trying to improve the methods. When we have things that work and things that don't work, we can look and we can try and understand what's different and improve the methods accordingly.
In the chat room, Tensor Guy was asking, would it be possible just to email the vaccine, right? Since you're working with DNA sequences, you could just say ATG, GTA, GTA, ATG, and just email it off and then have somebody synthesize the peptides.
So we do. They're exactly right, the person in the chat room. What we do is we get the sequences come out of the computer and we email those we email the DNA sequences to a company that then synthesizes the genes, sends them to us 2 weeks later. It's exactly what we do.
And then is your computer 50-50 wet bench algorithms or in silico work?
Most people do both. So you start at the computer, you do calculations, and say you're trying to make an inhibitor for a new flu virus, and you email off or you fill out the order form, you specify the ATG, whatever that corresponds to each of your 50 designs, you wait 2 weeks, then the genes come in little tubes, and then you put on your experimental hat and you go to the bench and you test them to see which ones work and how well they work. And then once you find the ones which work, then generally there's a number of experiments we can do to see how close to optimal they were and to make them even better.
Is there a deterministic way of have something designed, you test it, you notice that it works or it does not work in a certain way? Is then there an algorithmic way of how this feeds back into your overall approach? Can you then improve your design approach to make it more reliable next time?
Yes, definitely. And of course, that's we're doing that all the time. And so we have, every time we do an experiment, we look at the results and what we learned, and we feed that back to improve the underlying algorithms.
It froze up for a sec here. Liz, are we okay?
Hello? I can hear you.
Okay. The camera's on me, I guess. Bull in the chat room was asking, will Rosetta at Home project use GPU video card to contribute a CPU power or GPU power in the future?
We've taken some steps towards that. The difficulty is that Rosetta at Home is basically running the Rosetta program, which is very powerful in that it can do many different things, both the prediction problem we talked about and the design problem. And we're designing not only flu virus inhibitors, but also enzymes that carry out bioremediation and so forth. So we've had a hard time doing, there's so many different parts of the code that it's proving difficult to get this all onto the GPU. If you have part of it on the GPU and part of it on the CPU, then you end up spending a lot of time in communication between the GPU and CPU, and you don't get such speed up. So we won't have a GPU version in the immediate future, unfortunately. I'd very much like it if we did, but it's something beyond our – it would be very hard to do.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Foldit, but I'm kind of saving it for the last, I guess. How much human power – how much computational power are required to circumvent evolution and wet bench screening to get a molecule with a biological function?
That's an interesting question. I think it's hard to, I think one of the issues is that we don't have a perfect method. We don't have perfect algorithms. So the question really is, how much computer power do we need with our current imperfect algorithms? I think if we had better ones, which we're working towards all the time, the amount of time will be reduced. I think there's a trade-off. Right now, we need a lot of computing power because we need to learn what works and what doesn't work. For example, another problem that we approach in Rosetta at Home is the structure prediction problem, which is tied into the design problem in the following way. Suppose we design a sequence that's supposed to fold up into a structure that blocks the flu virus. The best test there is that our design is correct is to take that sequence and predict the structure. And we do that by folding it up many, many hundreds of thousands of times. It's the same way we approach on Rosetta at Home the prediction of the structure of naturally occurring proteins, but it's quite time consuming. So I think it will always take a lot of time to validate in silico that a sequence is predicted to fold up to the desired structure. So that will always take a lot of time. But the fraction of designs which are very effective inhibitors, for example, will increase over time as the methods improve. With Foldit, of course, it's a different type of computation because when we send out calculations to Rosetta at Home, that's classical, you know, computer calculation. With Foldit, it's the brain processing power of humans, and that's very hard to, you know, hard to quantify or relate to what to the way that a computer does processing.
I'd love to show Foldit. The problem is every time I do Skype screen sharing, Skype just won't send the video out. And we've had somewhat of a Skype nightmare today trying to get Skype to actually do some screen sharing. So what I'll do is recommend that everybody, if you Google Foldit, you'll find the website, you can download it, and there's three versions, right? The Windows, Mac OS X, and Linux, and play the game. Have some fun. Wiggle those side chains around. So basically you've got amino acids on that backbone, and which it forms that main structure that Liz is showing, and then those little arms, you move them around. Maybe you could tell us what those little starry things that are flashing are in this game. It's actually fun. It's I can't believe you guys made this fun, because you know we have a guy in the lab, he's doing this, and it doesn't seem as much fun as this game. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, what you see here is just you see a helix and some side chains coming off. And in the game, you can move the side chains around. And the colors on the backbone are basically indicate how low in energy it is. Right now, you've done something bad. And that's why you got those squiggly, those star-shaped things. Those are clashes. Now you've made it good. And you, congratulations there.
Yeah, this is YouTube video of someone playing.
So it's one of the things that's amazing is that Foldit players are just incredibly good at this. You realize one of the things I really appreciated with this is how smart people are. I think we evolved, you know, to solve problems that we hadn't encountered before. And this is certainly something that's not familiar in everyday life, you know, manipulating molecules. But the strategies that people have come up with are really, really neat. We had a paper in PNAS a couple months ago where we showed this really amazing thing, which is that when Foldit players first started producing their rather amazing results, I got very curious about how they were doing it. So I wrote to the top players and asked them what they were doing. And they wrote back these really complex, intricate, really neat descriptions, far more complicated than anything we would really implement in Rosetta, which is what the original idea had been, of course. So we decided that since Foldit players are so smart, we should let them figure out what they're doing. And so we created this sharing, this recipe creation opportunities where you can basically write simple scripts and share them with their friends. And when we did that, there was this huge proliferation of recipes in the community. Some people are nice and they share them. So those recipes really replicate fast. It's really like a Lamarckian evolution because people copy and extend. And we noticed after about 9 months that there were two recipes that were really taking over the population. And what was really remarkable when we looked at them is they had discovered the best algorithm we had been working on in my group. I told you we're always developing on trying to work on improved algorithms. Sure. They'd come up with something that was essentially conceptually identical to the best thing we'd come up with during the same time, and actually worked better in the context of the game. We've learned that folded players are not only good at manipulating proteins, but actually coming up with good automated ways for doing it.
This is funny. There was a, I don't know if it's art imitating nature, or nature imitating art, or science imitating nature. I don't know what it is, but Stargate Universe, the whole premise of the series was that there was this gamer that was actually really brilliant, and the lead scientists on Stargate had put out these problems for gamers to go and try and solve. And of course, he solves the game, and then the military come to his door and say, "You're coming with us," and they teleport him up to a ship. Are you recruiting some of these folks to do some modeling?
We already have. I mean, we've all the folded. Approach a new problem in the group, whether it's trying to inhibit a new virus or come up with a new way of fixing carbon dioxide, every new problem we have, when we get stuck, we ask folded players. So we already are recruiting them. Every folded player and Rosetta at Home participant is already a contributor to our research. Well, it's really their research too. I mean, it's a big collective effort.
Let me ask you another question, because this is sort of the framework of the whole process of getting a drug to market, right? You're translating a knowledge of here to proteins that are interacting. You want to block it to prevent a virus from infecting that target. You're going to have to go through clinical trials. You're going to need to know whether this protein is effective, safe, effective, and then how effective. And those clinical trials might cost upwards of $100 million or $50 to $100 million. You need to leverage the intellectual property typically to raise those funds to pay for the clinical trials. You're stuck. You're bound by the rules of commercialization to get a drug to market. One of the gamers came out with the design, his design typically, if he was a paid employee, a medicinal chemist designing a drug, would be shares in the company. Is there IP issues? Because you're public, it's like public knowledge when the game results are published, that you lose the ability to patent it. I mean, how does all that framework come together?
Well, let me describe how it works when a scientist or like someone in my group discovers something, because I think it's really the same. So I'm a professor at the University of Washington. So we're at the University of Washington. If we make a discovery, what happens is there are whoever in my group invented it is the inventor, or in this case of a folded player doing something, they would be the inventor, or there'd be generally a group of inventors. The invention would be disclosed to the University of Washington. The University of Washington, in some sense, owns the work that's being done. But what they do then is they would write a patent, and then they would try and license it to the technology to a company or an agency that would want to then do the development, all the testing that you described, which does cost hundreds of millions of dollars. They handle all of that. The inventors, if it goes on to be a blockbuster drug, the inventors, can choose what they want to do with whatever, royalties come in from that. But I don't think it'll really be any different for folded players than it would be for individuals who work at the university. The University of Washington is a public institution, so their mission is to take things that are made as part of research efforts and get them out into the real world and, try and save people's lives that way.
Well, there's always an important balance, right, for the entity that's going to take it and do the later stages of development. They have to protect the IP so that it's worth something. And it's it's the economic world out there, and so when somebody gets a good score on a structure and they're the winner of a competition, because you have competitions unfolded, is that structure revealed as, hey, here's how we did it? Or do is it kept quiet until the University of Washington's Technology Transfer Office has had the time to review the intellectual property and patent it? I have a biotech company here, and I'm always thinking of these things.
Those are good questions. I mean, so we haven't had that happen yet, but it would be just the way it happens in my group. Someone makes a discovery, like say these flu blocking proteins. Generally, it takes a long time before you actually write a scientific paper on the discovery. You know, so whether it's a discovery by folded players or by people in my group. And I should say that we've had three papers now that report folded players discoveries, and the folded players are of course authors on these papers, or they've actually preferred generally to have their team acknowledged, because the folded players have, even though we know who got the top score, they say, well, they couldn't have really done it on their own. They were talking to people on their team. So yeah, they're now, if you search PubMed, the big database of biomedical literature, you now find that players F is an index thing, which is folded players. They're the senior author on a number of papers we published. Then there's the folded contenders team, and various other teams. Void crushers team are also authors on papers. So it takes a long time to get to the point of writing the paper. And the university does like to file for some IP before that. We still talk about it. I feel like there's nothing that we do that we keep secret, but, and it doesn't take them very long to file stuff. So it hasn't really been an issue, and I don't expect it to be a big one.
So it's not really public disclosure to be playing the game.
What?
It's not a public disclosure to be playing the game. It's not, everything's not out there. When you're playing the game, it's a private game, and you guys have the data reviewed before before you publish it, I guess.
Well, let's see.
The game is not a publication.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, because we have to test the designs and show which ones work, and we generally have to optimize them a bit. So there's a lot of steps. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the publication is the public disclosure.
So you have to test it on the bench, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So do you know who your players are? Are they just random people who want to play computer games, or are these biology people as well who want to do something good for the world and actually kind of play this in the, you know, with the explicit goal of helping you guys?
Well, most of the players are not people with an extensive biological research background, and the reason is obvious. If your day job is to be is a biochemist, then you probably, especially if you're a computational biologist, the last thing you want to do is go home and for recreation play a game. So the folded players have a really wide variety of backgrounds, as do Rosetta at Home participants. In fact, many folded players are Rosetta at Home participants, and vice versa. So there's some really fascinating videos on folded players on YouTube. So I recommend looking at those, which are actually interviews with folded players who describe the various reasons that they participate in the project. I think people like the sense of community, of working together for the common good, making flu blockers and other things. They like participating, contributing to biomedical research. And it's fun. It's kind of like a three-dimensional version of Tetris.
Yeah. It is very fun. Compelling.
How did you gamify it, in the sense that how do you do the scoring? Is the scoring just simply the fitness of the of the folding, or is there more to it?
Right. Well, no, that's a funny story. So basically, I didn't describe how Foldit came about. We had Rosetta at Home project and when you run Rosetta at Home, a screensaver pops up. And so you see the course of the calculation, the protein folding up or being designed. And people started writing in and saying, well, the computer is making mistakes. I can see how to do this better. And so we teamed up with Zoran Popovic, a professor of computer science here at the UW, and jointly we've been working on Foldit. Basically, the idea is to make the whole thing interactive. It's like an interactive version of Rosetta at Home. But to answer your question, one of the big innovations was we found it wasn't very effective to have people compete to get the lowest energy. So what we do is we take the energy and multiply it by it minus 10. So the score comes out to be about, 1,000, 10,000. And you have to make it higher rather than lower. And that is... that has helped. That's basically all that So the folded score is the energy times minus 10.
Okay. Are there any success stories you can talk about where this thing really kind of, resulted in something kind of really interesting, revolutionary?
Right. There's three success stories so far. One got a lot of press back in September, where we were trying to with Rosetta, my research group also tries to solve protein structures. We'll predict them, but sometimes people are able to collect data and experimental data, but not enough data to really uniquely determine the structure, and so they're kind of stuck. So we can take that data and use it with Rosetta and Rosetta at Home to guide the search for the lowest energy structure. And we published a paper in Nature last year showing that when we got data sets from people who were stuck on solving structures, many different data sets, we were able to solve many of them. But there were a couple data sets which we weren't able to solve, and one of them came from Mariusz Dolskowski's group in Poland. It was for a retroviral protease. And we took that one and gave it to Folded players, and they were able to push. They were able to do their magic and actually produce a structure which fit the experimental data so well. It was very clearly the right solution. So they solved the structure of the protein, that was when we learned you should never publish a paper that says games, retrovirus, HIV, and structure in the same thing, because it created a perfect media storm. So then the second result was the one I described that we published a few months ago, showing that Folded players can also develop algorithms. And the most recent one was published in Nature Biotechnology just a couple weeks ago. And as I said, we've been developing with Rosetta. We're trying to design catalysts for chemical reactions, and we had designed a catalyst for a reaction called the Diels-Alder reaction. We published that in Science a couple of years ago, but it wasn't really a very good catalyst, and so we challenged the Folded players to make it better. And they succeeded in doing a radical redesign of the enzyme. They made it about 20-fold better, and that was really exciting. So that was the first case where Folded players really managed to improve a design very considerably. We're very excited now trying to give out all sorts of new design problems, because Folded players look at the problem a little bit different than a trained biochemist would. And so it's often good in science just to have a different perspective.
Yeah, my six-year-old kid would love this game. And there's the biology there. You see the peptide backbone, and you see the side chains, and you're looking for those low energy positions. I see that myself. Interesting, here's some interesting chemistry, but my six-year-old won't care. He'll just be playing it, getting higher score and higher score and higher score. Yeah. I had him playing chess on the iPad, and at one point I say, "Hey, hand me the iPad. I'll show you the scholar's mate. It's the four-move checkmate." And I try it, and it didn't work. And I was like, "This is puzzling. It should work." And I always do it, and it always works. And he says, "Give me the iPad." He takes the iPad from me. He goes into the settings, moves it from difficult to easy, and hands me back the iPad, because to him it was just a video game, and he'd won at the first level and the second level and third level, and he just naturally slid the the settings to difficult. So this game that you have is one of those games that I think even kids today could enjoy, and because there's it's really a problem solving game and a strategy game.
It definitely is.
You've translated the fun part very, very compellingly. So I think it's really exciting. Do you see that game going to the next step, where you could dissociate the structures that we're looking at and give it an overlay that has nothing to do with the game, and have people problem solving in something that might be completely unrelated? They might be looking for treasure on an island in a cyber environment, whereas that actually is solving protein structure. Do you see, or is this going to be the main sort of metaphor? Are you going to stick with the biology metaphor?
It's a good question, but I think we'll stick for solving these structure, protein design problems. I think we have to stick in the protein space, because when you abstractify it, you really lose a lot of the essentials. So, and you might have thought that people wouldn't be so good at working in this protein space, and that you needed to translate it into like searching for treasure on an island. But actually, it turns out that people are very good at working in the protein space, much, much better than I expected. And I should say much, much better than I am.
Well, it's kind of neat that it worked out. We've interviewed Vijay Pandey from Stanford several times on the Folding at Home, and that paradigm, of using distributed computing to do crystallography or protein folding studies is interesting. But you've taken it to the next step, and I think it's really exciting. And there's a lot of metaphorical.
Unfortunately, I'm gonna have to leave soon.
Sure.
To go plan the next episode for Hold It.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a last question. Do you consider this people doing evolution or people doing intelligent design? Because you're creating life.
I think it's design much more than evolution. Evolution is a random process, process of random mutation and selection. And folded is much more a process of design. They're playing God, quite clearly.
They are. So this is the first, maybe it's always existed. Maybe anyway, I won't go into that. But this is really fun. I encourage people to go down to go to your website, go to Fold It, just Google Fold It, and you'll find it right away. And download it and start playing. And you're going to be, you know, these are very pragmatic projects. The things that you're doing will translate to clinic. So that's really, really exciting.
And try Rosetta at home also. That's another way to participate in this, that we encourage people to do both. Because with Rosetta at home, you see problems that are sort of the leading up to Fold It.
That's really cool. We'll do.
Okay, all right. Well, goodbye, everybody.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, bye.
Bye.
Our guest today was Dr. David Baker. He's professor of biochemistry at the University of Washington. It's pretty wild, eh, Marcus, when you cross gaming with intelligent design and the modulating life, basically, or changing life.
Yeah, actually, this is really the first sensible definition of intelligent design that I've seen or heard, because there are really intelligent people designing life. So it's funny.
Just call the game God. Just call it God, right?
Yeah.
Because you're actually playing God. I mean, this is whether God or it's a passive whatever. That's a discussion to be had over a beer and with theologists. But the concept of life being modified using a design is great. But then it is a fun game. I've played with it. It's like the 4th of July, the fireworks, like New Year's. Every time you succeed on lowering the energy score, there's a reward system of bells and whistles. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's also really fascinating how computation becomes a more and more important aspect of biology, and how then Moore's law kind of applies to biological progress. It's fascinating stuff.
Well, that is very, very important. We're at the stage in the technology or in biotechnology where one may ask, should I put the effort and the resources towards solving these problems on the bench with known technologies? I know that if I take a protein and then I try to test for things that will block it, I can do that on the bench. And, you know, I've always trusted that is doable. If you're just patient enough and you do your chemistry right, it will happen. Now, if I could just buy a MacBook Air and run an algorithm on it and just have it go for 3 weeks, you know, these Core i7s are really fast. I could, you know, save 3 years work and actually the cost of buying those libraries. I bought a 120,000 compound library. It cost so 200,000 compound library. It cost $120,000, right? Mm-hmm. But then we screened in silico, and that took the Christmas holidays on 3 iMacs, right?
Yep.
But we're still testing those in silico hits, right? So we're not sure yet whether we've been able to apply some of these computer algorithms to replace the wet bench chemistry. But this is the frontier, and I think Dr. Baker is creating a new structure, a new framework for technology, biotech, to move forward in the control of life, and he's going to save some lives with it. You know, he's going to be Dr. McCoy. He's going to give Dr. McCoy his tools. Yeah, synthesize a vaccine, just like that. Email it to the folks back home on Subspace Channel, right?
Yep. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
Our guest host. Yeah, it's great. We'll have you back. We'll do a lot of this. This is a new field, and we'll have you on to help figure out this from the software side.
Cool. Absolutely.
Our guest host is Marcus Volter, and he's the editor in chief of a podcast series called Omega Tau Podcast. So you can find his work at Omega Tau, STAU. So Omega TAU podcast.net. And he's got a lot of great science and engineering shows. It's broad range. You do aviation, you do software engineering, you do electrical engineering, you do pure science. It's great production value, by the way.
Yeah, I looked at Leo's microphones and his analog equipment and basically bought the same stuff.
Well, you know, everything starts at Leo. The world of podcasting started there. Well, so thank you for coming on. And
thank you for having me. Hey, that was a lot of fun.
It is. This is great. Twit is fun. This is why I do the show. It's a lot of fun. Yep. I get to meet some great people too. So I do it as a great way to network in my field. I'd like to also thank Liz Romero for handling the audio and video boards today. Great job. She can predict the future. She knows where to go, and I don't know how you do it. I'd also like to thank Jeff Stewart and his team for editing the show. Thanks to Chief Twit, Leo, Leo Laporte, and the entire crew at the Brickhouse that make this fun to do and easy to do. They certainly work really hard at it. Also, if you have any comments or suggestions, I could be reached at mark@twit.tv or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier, MarkPelletier. So for Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.